Today, we will do some more derivatives. And we won't even be done with the derivatives or derivations after today. Essentially, what we're aiming for today is the directional derivative. Now, we already know a directional derivative, right? It's the tangent vectors. Each tangent vector is a directional derivative for scalar functions. But what we will do today is define directional derivatives for general differential forms, not just functions, not just zero forms, but for general forms. And then we will further generalize that to a directional derivative for all tensors. And we start again with the algebraic approach. As a preliminary tool, we will have to define first another derivative, another derivation, the so-called inner derivation. The inner derivation will generalize the inner product, like evaluating a tangent vector against a cotangent vector. You can also evaluate a tangent vector against any form, and we'll define that. Okay, so let me remind you, the set lambda of differential forms on a manifold is an associative algebra. It's not commutative, but it's associative. And it's called also called the Grassmann algebra over the manifold. The multiplication that we defined for the Grassmann algebra is the wedge product. And remember that it takes an S form and an R form into an S plus R form. So the wedge product of a 2-form and a 3-form is a 5-form. Then we defined a derivation on that algebra. Remember, derivations are linear maps that obey a Leibniz rule or graded Leibniz rule. And so in particular, we defined the exterior derivative, the D operator, that maps differential forms into differential forms. It is an antiderivation of degree k equal 1. Remember, antiderivation means that there could be a minus sign in the Leibniz rule, depending on the degree of the first of the two forms in the product that we want to anti-differentiate. Of degree k equal 1 means that it takes a 2-form into a 3-form, a 5-form into a 6-form, and so on. Now, as I said, our aim today is going to be to define directional derivatives. The D operator is not a directional derivative, right? It kind of differentiates differential forms. We saw that it involves taking first derivatives. But there's no way to input a choice of direction, saying that we want to differentiate in this direction or that direction. But of course, that's what we will need that for physics applications. So how to define a directional derivative? Now remember, tangent vectors are already directional derivatives, but tangent vectors differentiate what? Well, they differentiate functions, right? They give you the weighted sum of the partial derivatives with respect to x1, x2, x3, x4, right? And the weight is, the weights are the direction in which you differentiate. So the tangent vector 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, for example, is the directional derivative in the one direction. Now, in order to arrive at a directional derivative on differential forms, we first define another derivation of a very simple kind, and that will be useful for defining then a directional derivative, but which will also come up in other contexts. So what we will define next as an intermediate tool on the way to a directional derivative is an antiderivation that we will call the inner derivation, and we will denote it by I subscript xi. An inner because of, think of inner product. It's a generalization of inner product to differential forms. Okay, so the inner derivation is going to be, by definition, an antiderivation, so again, there's a minus sign in the Leibniz rule. And it's going to be of degree k equal minus 1. You haven't seen such a thing before yet. Degree k equal minus minus 1 means that, well, it'll map a 3 form into a 2 form. And a 2 form into a 1 form. 0 form into nothing. Okay? And what is it going to do? It's going to generalize, taking the inner product of a direction vector, that is to say a tangent vector, and a 1 form, which is to say a cotangent vector. And then, once we have that inner derivation, then we can combine it with the exterior derivation that we already defined to obtain a derivation of degree k equal 1, which we will call the Lie derivative. That's going to be the directional derivative. Now, why would we want to have a derivation of degree k equal 1? Well, that would be a derivation that takes 5 forms into 5 forms, 2 forms into 2 forms. That's what it should be if we do a directional derivative. Let's say we ask at what rate does a 3 form change in a particular direction? Right, then the answer to that should be a 3 form. Right? If you take any object and you differentiate it with respect to a parameter, it should preserve its structure. So in particular, 3 forms should have parameterized family of 3 forms when differentiated with respect to the parameter should be a 3 form again. But the exterior derivative is a derivation of degree k equal 1. Now, the inner derivation has degree k equal minus 1, and we will be able to combine them such that we get the so-called Lie derivative, which will be a derivation of degree k equal 0, and will have the properties that we want of a directional derivative. Oh, this thing is not scrolling continuously. Sorry about it. Why is it not scrolling? Oh, there we go. Okay, so the inner derivation. Let's assume that xi is a tangent vector. That's the direction in which we want to differentiate. And now we want to define an antiderivation I xi of degree k equal minus 1. That is to say a linear map which maps s forms into s minus 1 forms. So if omega is an s form, Ixi of omega should be an s minus 1 form. And since it's to be a derivation, it obeys the anti-Leibniz rule. Here, remember this minus sign, which could be there or not be there. It depends on the power r here, which is the degree of the first of the two differential forms. Also remember that because of the linearity of derivations and because of the property of the Leibniz rule of derivations, it suffices to specify a derivation or antiderivation on the zero forms and on the one forms, and then that already determines what it does on all differential forms. So all we have to specify is what it does on zero and one forms. And by definition, we will say that the inner derivation is supposed to map functions into zero. Well, what else should it map into? Because it's an antiderivation of degree k equal minus 1. So it has to take 2 forms into 1 forms, 1 forms into 0 forms, 0 forms into nothing. It's also supposed to map the 1 forms into 0 forms in the following way. It maps a differential form, one form, into the number that, or the function that you get when you evaluate that one form on the direction vector. So we have to specify how this thing differentiates one form, which is to say we have to specify how it differentiates a cotangent vector. And it does it in the following way. By definition, the inner derivation takes a cotangent vector and maps it, or cotangent vector field, and maps it into the function, function means lambda zero, maps it into the function obtained by evaluating the cotangent vector onto the tangent vector. This is the reason why this derivation is going to be called the inner derivation, because this is like an inner product. You evaluate two vectors against each other. So as we said, bilinearity and the anti-Leibniz rule, this already defines then what our inner derivation does on the entire Grassmann algebra. And in particular, how on earth? How can I skip a page here? See. Oh, there we go. Okay. Yeah, in particular, how does it, oh no, how does one go back? All right, let's just calculate that. Oh, this is terrible. There we go. Okay, so how does it act on the entire differential algebra? Let's assume gamma is an S form, then the inner derivation of gamma in the direction of psi is an S minus 1 form, and it acts as follows. Remember that an S form takes as input S tangent vectors, and then outputs a function. Okay? Differential forms are, a differential S form is in particular covariant tensor of rank S, so therefore it feeds on S tangent vectors and then outputs a number, or if you look at the entire manifold, a function. Now, assume we're given gamma, then the inner derivation of gamma is going to be a differential S minus 1 form. So it takes as input no longer S tangent vectors, it takes as input only S minus 1 tangent vectors. And now we are saying what it does with these S minus 1 tangent vectors. The inner derivation of our S form in the direction of psi is an S minus 1 form. As an S minus 1 form, it expects S minus 1 tangent vectors as inputs. Here we are writing S minus 1 arbitrary tangent vectors. They are to be the inputs into this S minus 1 form. And by definition here, what the output is this. Actually, I shouldn't say it's a definition. I should remove these two dots there. It's a proposition. One can prove that this is, according to how we defined it to act on the zero forms and the one forms, this comes out to be simply the S form evaluated at these S tangent vectors. We feed in the S minus 1 tangent vectors eta, and simply the direction vector that we started with as the first argument. So the inner derivation is really doing something very simple. You take a differential form, and if you want to differentiate it in the direction of the vector field psi, you just plug the vector field psi as the first argument into your S form. And then what you're left with is an S minus 1 form. That's what it does. So the claim here is that given how we defined the inner derivation to act on zero forms and one forms, namely on zero forms, it annihilates. On one forms, it just takes the inner product. Given that, and then the anti-Leibniz rule, this is a consequence. So the inner derivation is super simple. Just plug your direction vector as the first argument into the S form, and that gives you an S minus 1 form. Okay, example. Let's say gamma is a 2 form, and it's a 2 form generated by taking the wedge product of a one form omega and a one form nu. Then what is the inner derivation of this two form? It has to be a one form, right? Now let's work it out by the Leibniz rule. So what we are able to use is the Leibniz rule, and that we know, in fact by construction, we know how the inner derivation acts on zero forms and one form. All right, so we want to calculate that. We do that by using the Leibniz rule. The inner derivation of gamma in the direction of xi is the inner derivation of, well, whatever gamma is. In this case, it's omega veg nu in the direction of xi. Now we use the anti-Leibniz rule. And the anti-Leibniz rule says anti-differentiate the first factor, leaving the second the same. So inner differentiate the first factor, the omega, and leave the nu alone, plus, and then there's going to be this minus one factor. It's minus one to the power of one because omega is a one form. And then we leave alone the first factor and then veg the inner derivation of the second factor. Also, by construction, we know what this is and what that is. We know, because we defined it in this way, what the action of the inner derivation is on one form. Namely, this is a tangent vector, that's a cotangent vector. We evaluate them against each other. So therefore, this is just omega of xi, which is a function because you're evaluating tangent against cotangent vector field, the function, times nu. See, this veg became an ordinary product because this is a zero form and that's a one form. And by convention, the veg product between an S form and a zero form is usually written without the veg. Okay, and then minus omega times psi nu. Now let us apply the differential one form that we just obtained. Let us apply this derivative, the inner derivation of gamma, let us apply it to a tangent vector. You see, this inner derivation is a one form now. That's a one form because it's the linear combination of this one form and that one form. But let us apply this one form to a tangent vector. Let us feed it a tangent vector as input. This evaluates then into a function. So we take our one form obtained by inner differentiating the gamma, and it's expecting a tangent vector field. We feed it the tangent vector field eta. So what do we obtain? The omega of xi is just a prefactor, and then this is a one form that is being fed eta as the input, the tangent vector field. So it's nu of eta. And then minus, this is just a function that we can carry forward, and then we feed the tangent vector eta into omega to give us another function. So this is a function, this is a zero form. It's what we obtain when we take this one form and evaluate it against some vector field. Let us compare that with the claim of the proposition. Remember, the proposition was that the inner derivation acts by taking the direction vector xi and plugging it into the first factor, into the first argument of your differential form. All right, so we take the inner derivation of our two-form gamma and evaluate that against a tangent vector. That's a zero form in total, right? Because gamma is a two form, ixi gamma is a one form. When applied to a tangent vector field, it evaluates into a zero form, a function. Okay, so this is the inner derivation of omega veg nu by definition of what gamma is, that we want to evaluate against eta. Now let's remember what omega veg nu is in the as a tensor. As a tensor, it's omega tensor nu minus nu tensor omega, because the veg product is the anti-symmetrized product up to factorial prefactors. So what we're dealing with is the inner derivation of omega veg nu minus nu veg omega, and then we have to apply that to the tangent vector field. By the proposition, what we have to do is plug the first slot here with xi. So the omega of xi here, plugging the xi into the first tensor factor, and then We plug the xi into the first tensor factor here as well, nu of xi. And then the outcome of that is a one form in which we plug that tangent vector field eta. So overall, we get this expression here, the xi into the first tensor factor and then the eta into the second. And that is, of course, the same as what we just obtained over here. All right, so we know now how the inner derivation acts on all differential forms. It is now possible to define, to calculate various properties of the inner derivation that we will need from time to time. First property is that if you first inner differentiate in the direction of psi 1 and then in the direction of psi 2, it's minus of what you would get if you did it the other way around. You see why that would be? It's basically because inner derivation means take your vector field, the direction vector field, and plug it into the first factor. So if you do this, remember this little circle means concatenation. First do this and then do that, right? If you do this, it means plug psi 1 as the first factor into your differential form, and then plug psi 2 as the second into the second slot, right? And that's, of course, the negative, as if you did it the other way around, because the differential form is antisymmetric in all of its arguments. So if instead of psi 1 and psi 2 going to the first and second slot, you put them into the second and first slot, well, you can undo that with a minus sign. That's why you get this. And in particular, if you inner differentiate twice with the same direction vector, then you annihilate, right? So you have ixi after ixi is zero. Now, you can see this because if you choose the two xi's to be the same, you see that something is equal to its negative. But it's also clear because you can't anti-symmetrize something that's symmetric, right? If you put the same tangent vector field into the first and the second slot of a differential form, then because the differential form is antisymmetric in all of its arguments, it will kill what you input. So we have ixi after ixi is zero. Just like d squared is zero, I squared is zero too, right? So the exterior derivative d after d is zero. This thing too has the property that when applied twice, it's zero. Remember how tangent vectors and cotangent vectors evaluate against each other? Let me just remind you of, I said that already, if xi is a tangent vector field and gamma is a cotangent vector field, then if we do the inner derivation of the one form gamma in the direction of the tangent vector field xi, then by definition, that's the evaluation of the cotangent vector field against the tangent vector field. But remember how that works. A cotangent vector eats up a tangent vector by letting the tangent vector eat up the cotangent vector. It doesn't matter which way you do that. Are you familiar with the fact that the dual of a dual vector space is the original vector space again, right? So you can say that a dual vector is a linear map of the original vector space into the real numbers. You can also hold the dual vector fixed and then choose any arbitrary original vector, and it will be acting as a linear map. You can always write xi of gamma or gamma of xi. It's just a general property of linear algebra that the set of linear maps on the set of linear maps is the original vector space. The dual of the dual is the original vector space again. The Hermitian conjugate of a bra is a ket, and the Hermitian conjugate of a ket is a bra. Okay, so what we see here is that the inner derivation of a cotangent vector field in the direction of a tangent vector field xi is an inner product. And if gamma is not a one form, but is an arbitrary S form, then we continue to call this the inner product. So basically, if we have tangent vector field against cotangent vector field, then it's the inner product in the usual sense. But if it's a tangent vector field evaluated against some arbitrary P form, then we still call it the inner product, even though it just fills one of the P slots. Let's just keep in mind the association between inner product and inner derivation. Okay, so now we are ready to define the Lie derivative, what we were really after, namely the directional derivative of P forms. We start with the algebraic definition for the Lie derivative on differential forms. And then we will generalize the Lie derivative so that it acts not only on differential forms, but on all tensors. Remember, differential forms are covariant tensors that are completely antisymmetric. But there are many more tensors than that. And we may want to differentiate also arbitrary other tensors directionally. For example, we will need to differentiate the metric in certain directions. For example, to find out whether there are conservation laws or not. We need to discover symmetries, Killing vector fields. You have heard about these things. Okay, so the Lie derivative. Now, remember that tangent vector fields were already introduced at the beginning as directional derivatives. So they map functions into functions. Now, how can we generalize the notion of directional derivatives to all of the Grassmann algebra? Let's see what we have at hand. We have the exterior derivative that maps S forms into S plus one forms. And what it was designed to do is to generalize the notion of a differential, the differential being the notion that maps functions into tangent vectors. For example, the coordinate functions xi into the dxi. So that notion was generalized to the entire Grassmann algebra when we defined the D on the entire Grassmann algebra. Just now, we saw that the notion of evaluation of vectors against covectors generalizes also to the entire algebra of differential forms, to the evaluation of tangent vectors against any differential form simply by plugging it in as the first argument. That was the inner derivation. Take an S form, plug the xi as the first argument, and you get an S minus one form. And just to anticipate already what will happen, the Lie derivative will turn out to be the anticommutator of the exterior and the inner derivation. You can see how this is going to be a derivation of degree k equals zero. So it will map S forms into S forms, because the D will raise the degree, will turn an S form into an S plus one form, but this is reducing the degree again from an S plus one form to an S form, and here the other way around. Okay, so it's not clear yet, of course, why that would be coming out, but I just wanted to show you already what is going to come up. So the Lie derivative, we design now a derivative, which we call the Lie derivative, which has certain desired properties, because we want it to be a directional derivative. So as a directional derivative, it should be a derivation, not an antiderivation. A directional derivative should not have any funny behavior. Should be as expected, and therefore there shouldn't be any funny minus signs over there. So the Lie derivative acting on the product of two differential forms should act with the usual Leibniz rule. Also, it should map R forms into R forms, as we discussed earlier. So what we are looking for is a derivation of degree k equals zero. That's what we want to define. And now we need to specify how it acts on zero forms and one forms, and then we're done. then we know how it acts on all differential forms. And in order to define how it acts in zero forms and one forms, we take as guidance that we want it to be a directional derivative. So on functions, on zero forms, therefore, the Lie derivative is supposed to be just the ordinary directional derivative. So if we take functions, then the Lie derivative should map them into functions. And how? Well, the Lie derivative should take our function and map it into the directional derivative of the function in the traditional sense. Just by evaluating the tangent vector onto the function, which in practice, of course, means this. Xi is a tangent vector field. Being a tangent vector field, it's a linear combination of the partial derivatives. And we apply that to the function. That whole thing is a function again. OK, so now we know that the Lie derivative is going to be, I mean, we define it to be a derivation of degree k equal 1, degree k equals 0, that acts on zero forms in this way, simply by having the directional derivative field xi act onto the function. Now we still have to define how it acts on a basis of one forms. So remember, once we define a derivation on the zero forms and the one forms, then by linearity in the Leibniz rule, it is defined on all differential forms. So for example, the DF are one forms for any F. For example, the D of the exterior derivative of the coordinate functions, they are one forms. Now, how should we define the directional derivative of a one form in the direction of a tangent vector field xi? The idea here is to require that the Lie derivative that we're about to define is commuting with the exterior derivative. Namely, it is natural to define now the directional derivative of a gradient field, so of a DF, of a cotangent vector field of a particular kind, to be the gradient of the directional derivative of the function. Basically, we want to recycle the fact that we know how to directionally differentiate functions. By doing this, we say that the Lie derivative is supposed to map one forms into one forms, and in particular, these one forms into what we obtain when we do the directional derivative of the function, and then the exterior derivative. If this is a sensible definition, then we are done. It will generalize to the entire Grassmann algebra. Why? It's because we are defining herewith how the Lie derivative acts on enough one form. Remember, we don't have to define it on all one forms, just on a basis of one form. And among the DF are in particular the DX1, DX2, DX3, up to DXN, which form a basis in the cotangent space. Therefore, by defining how the Lie derivative acts on the DF, we are defining how it acts on a basis. And therefore, we can already generalize and find out how it acts on all one forms and on all S forms. All right, so again, the definition is that the Lie derivative of a one form of that shape, which is a gradient, which is the D of some function, the Lie derivative in a direction of of Xi of a one form of that form, that is to say, of an exact of a gradient, is what you do when you first do the directional derivative and then the d. You see, the lead derivative on the d is the d of the lead derivative. Because remember, this is the lead derivative, just for the case of zero form. So we are basically saying that the lead derivative is to commute with the exterior derivative. The directional derivative of a gradient is the gradient of the directional derivative. That's what we require here. Lead derivative of df is d of the lead derivative of f. Now, we have the lead derivative defined on all differential forms, because we can always use the Leibniz rule to break up wedge products of higher rank differential forms into lower rank differential forms, for which we already know how to evaluate the lead derivative. And so by induction, we know how it acts on all of the differential forms. Now, at this point, we can prove the formula that I showed you at the very beginning, namely the formula that relates the lead derivative to the exterior derivation and the inner derivation. Remember, I said that the lead derivative is actually the anti-commutator of the exterior and the inner derivation, where this is raising the degree of a differential form by one, and that's lowering it by one, so that overall the lead derivative is not changing the degree of a differential form. By the way, I leave it to you as an exercise to check from that the lead derivative is a derivation of degree k equals zero. I mean, that actually obeys the Leibniz rule. Just a bit of algebra to exercise things. Okay, but let's check that our lead derivative is really expressible in this simple form. This equation being called the Cartan equation. Right? What do we have to check in order to check whether that's true? We only have to check that it is true on zero forms and one forms again. Because if it holds on zero forms and one forms, then that map by linearity and the Leibniz rule is obeying it everywhere. So let's check it on zero forms. The lead derivative of a function is, by Cartan's formula, it is the inner derivation of the function and then the exterior derivative plus the other way around, but the interior derivative of a function is zero, right? Remember that the interior derivative is a derivation of degree k equal minus one. It maps two forms into one forms into zero forms into nothing. So that term will go away. Plus, and then we have the exterior derivative of f, which is a one form, and then we plug in this tangent vector field, which gives us, once evaluated, a function. So we obtain that it is zero plus, and then remember how that acts. We take the df, which is a one form, and plug in the xi into its first argument. Well, it has only one argument, it's a one form. So it's df evaluated on xi, which we can also write as xi of f. Remember, this is how the cotangent vector field df acts on the vector field. It's by letting the vector field act on the function. That's how we first define directional derivative. Okay, and this agrees with how we defined the lead derivative in the first place. If you remember, how did we defined how the lead derivative is to act on zero forms, namely as the directional derivative, which is psi of f, and then we also defined how it acts on one forms. Now let's see from that whether we get the same action on one forms. So now let's consider the lead derivative of df, which is a one form, and we can get a basis of these guys. So it suffices to work with those. So the Lie derivative on df is, by Cartan's formula, d after the exterior after the interior derivative of df plus the external after the internal after the external derivative. Now here, in this case, the first term survives and the second term is zero. So what do you have to do? We have to take the inner derivation of df. Now df is a cotangent vector field. It waits for a tangent vector to be plugged in. So df of xi, which is xi of f, so we have xi of f here, and then we have to apply the d to that. And this term is vanishing because we have d after d. That's zero. So we have the d of xi f. And that's how we defined previously the action of the Lie derivative on one form. We said that the exterior derivative is supposed to commute with the Lie derivative. And that's exactly what we say here. The Lie derivative after d is the d after the Lie derivative, because xi of f is the Lie derivative on zero forms. Okay, so we see that the Cartan formula is consistent with how we defined our Lie derivative. Therefore, instead of specifying what the Lie derivative does on zero forms and on one form, we could also have simply written down the Cartan equation. And that as well would have meant the same action on the zero forms and the one forms. So that would have generated the same derivation. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. The Lie derivative is related to the exterior derivative in this way, namely as the anticommutator with the anticommutator of the external and the internal derivation. Now let's define commutators. Just like in quantum mechanics, we define that for any linear maps, any linear maps from differential forms into differential forms, any two linear maps A and B that map differential forms into differential forms, we define their commutator to be, the commutator of the two actions. And then what kind of maps do we have in mind? Well, for example, the exterior derivation maps differential forms into differential forms, and the inner derivation and the Lie derivation all do that. They all map differential forms into differential forms, and we can ask, what's commutative here and what's not, and how do they commute? What are the canonical commutation relations of differential geometry? Well, one can prove the following, and we won't go through all the details. You can consider this to be little exercises. So we have that the exterior derivative commutes with the Lie derivative. Remember that went into the definition of how the Lie derivative acts on one forms, for example. Okay, so the exterior derivative and the Lie derivative commute. That's great. And then we have this beauty here. We have that if you first differentiate in one direction and then a direction and differentiate into another direction, then it's the same as differentiating and then the other way around. That's the same as directionally differentiating in this direction. Okay, that's a new direction. You see, tangent vector fields are maps from functions into functions. And in particular, this means that you can apply them after another. You can apply a tangent vector field onto a function, and then another tangent vector field onto a function, another tangent vector field onto the function, and so on. So in particular, there are commutators between tangent vector fields. I'll show you in a moment how these work out explicitly. So this is a non-trivial thing here, because remember that that's a first derivative. That's a first derivative. We apply them one after the other because this involves, you know, the product of two Lie derivatives. And then we are claiming, hey, it's just a first derivative. How did that happen? Let's see in a moment how that works. And then we have the commutator between the Lie derivative and the interior derivative, and that's the interior derivative evaluated at that. Not that hard to see once you remember what the interior derivation does. It takes the argument and plugs it into the first fact of the differential form, and then you use Cartan's formula. So you can see how within two or three lines you can prove it. Okay, so what we use here on the right-hand side, here as well as there, is that there is such a thing as the commutator between two tensor fields, between two vector fields. Now, we're not used to thinking of vector fields as things that we, as operators, but they are. A vector field is an operator on the space of functions on the manifold, right? Because a vector field maps a function into a function, like a derivative operator, like the momentum operator, maps functions into functions. So a vector field maps functions into functions. And so you can apply vector field after vector field and so on. What is non-trivial is that the commutator of two vector fields is a vector field again. That the commutator of two of these directional derivatives is not a second derivative, but is a first derivative. Let's see how that comes about explicitly. So let's say f is a function, it's a zero form, and we take two tangent vector fields, xi and eta. And we apply first eta and then xi, and then we subtract the action of first xi and then eta. Or the other way around. So what we have is, we have that eta acts on f, that's just a tangent vector field doing its job of directionally differentiating f. So we get another function. On that function, we apply the xi, which is again directionally differentiating that function. And then we subtract what we get if we do this in the other sequence. Now, what is that explicitly? Well, so what we have here is eta acting on f. So that's the weighted directional derivative here, the weighted sum of the partial derivatives acting on f. That is a function here, right? And then we apply the tangent vector field xi, which is again a weighted sum of partial derivatives on that function. Now, these coefficient functions are dependent on space and time, our variables anyway. So this derivative is acting on these guys too, right? So this derivative acts not just on the f, but also on the eta. And similarly here, the other way around. So we get two types of terms. We get terms where the derivative acts on the f, leaving the eta alone. We get terms where the derivative acts on the eta, and that's not further differentiated. These terms are of a very different nature, because when this derivative acts on that, then we get second derivatives of f. Second derivatives of it. On the other hand, by the Leibniz rule, this also acts on the eta, and then we have a first derivative of eta multiplying a first derivative of f. Similarly here. Now all the terms with the second derivatives are going to go away. Why? Well, let's look at it. We have, by the product rule, terms where this derivative acts after that derivative here. So what we have is xi, eta, and then derivative, derivative f. Minus what? Minus the same thing exactly, because we also have here eta, xi, and then derivative, derivative. You see, it doesn't, the two derivatives commute with each other. That's symmetric. D by dxi, d by dxj is the same as d by dxj, d by dxi. But we have a minus sign between the two. Therefore, all those terms with the second derivatives go away. They don't make it into the next line. And the only terms that survive are the terms where these derivatives act on those prefactor functions there. So what we get is that of these two terms here and two terms there, two cancel, namely the guys with the second derivatives, and the terms that survive are these, the terms with the first derivatives only. So we have the first derivative of f, and then we have these terms where we differentiate these coefficient functions. So what we obtain is that the commutator of two tangent fields is in fact a tangent field again, because it's a weighted sum of the partial derivatives of the partial first derivatives of a function. Okay, so the key takeaway here is that surprisingly, the commutator of two tangent fields is a tangent field. Therefore, that makes sense to write down these things. In other words, the vector space of tangent fields forms an algebra because it's closed under the commutators there. Okay, so I mean it forms an algebra anyway, but what I wanted to say is that you have a Lie algebra that they form because of the commutator closing into the tangent vector fields again. Okay, so what we have now completed the definition of the Lie derivation. We know how it's acting on zero forms, one forms, all of its properties. It's a derivation, not an antiderivation. It's of degree k equals zero. It obeys the Cartan formula. It is the anti-commutator of the internal and the interior and the exterior derivative. And we showed that it commutes with the exterior derivative, and it has these commutator relations with the inner derivation. But we haven't seen how it might relate to a Newton-Leibniz kind of derivative. There ought to be a way to see the Lie derivative as differentiating in the Newton-Leibniz sense, where you say the derivative of a function is the limit for epsilon going to zero of the function here minus the function there divided by the distance between the two locations, and then letting that distance epsilon go to zero. Right, so that would be the usual Newton-Leibniz limit of calculating a derivative. Now, we'll do two things at once. We will first show that this is possible. The Lie derivative can be viewed as the Newton-Leibniz limit of certain difference taking. And secondly, while we do it, we use it also to vastly generalize the notion of Lie derivative. Because so far, the algebraic definition of it only gave us a Lie derivative acting on differential forms. But as I said, we may also want to Lie differentiate other tensors later on for purposes of general relativity. So we will now do the Newton-Leibniz definition of the Lie derivative. And we will do it for all tensors, not just the totally antisymmetric covariant tensors that are the differential forms. Okay, so let us ask. Since the Lie derivative is the directional derivative on the differential forms, can the Lie derivative be extended to a directional derivative for all tensor fields? Yes, that's possible. And what we want is, and we do that by redefining the Lie derivative from scratch, this time analytically rather than algebraically. We will express the Lie derivative similar to the Newton-Leibniz formula for derivatives. Except, as you may imagine, this part is the difficult part. Right? Because here, if we're dealing with ordinary functions on the real line, well, then we can say, okay, we take the value of the function at x plus epsilon and subtract the value of the function at x. But for a differentiable manifold, if you go from one location x to another location nearby, well, epsilon wouldn't make sense. It has to be, you know, x and some point a little bit further away. Then if this is a tensor in the tensor space to that point of the manifold, and that's a tensor in the tensor space, such as the tangent space, cotangent space, general tensor space, at another point, well, then you can't take the difference between the two. See, you can't take for example, the difference between a cotangent vector here and a cotangent vector there. They live in different vector spaces, so you can't take their difference. And generally, if you have two points on the manifold, some small distance epsilon apart, how can you calculate the difference between a tensor here and a tensor there? They live in different tensor spaces. This is where it's useful now, that we drew these complicated pictures before. Remember where we had a map from manifold into manifold, a diffeomorphism from manifold into manifold. And then we said, that induces for us a pullback that maps functions here into functions there. And that induces a tension map that maps tension vectors here into tension vectors over there. And that induces a map that maps cotangent vectors here into cotangent vectors there. And that generalizes to a map that maps tensors here into tensors there. That's what we need. Because that tells us that if we have a diffeomorphism from a manifold into a manifold, we have a then we have a map of tensors into tensors. And if the map, the diffeomorphism, is from the manifold into itself, just shifted a little bit, then we get a map from tensors into tensors here to tensors there. So we can take a tensor, the value of a tensor vector, a tensor field here, and map that tensor over there so that they live in the same tensor space, and then they can be subtracted, and then we can get a Newton-Leibniz limit out of that. So this is what we're going to do now. The geometric definition of the Lie derivative. And I already gave you the gist of it. It's just making sense of that epsilon. And we will need the pullbacks and push forwards for that. OK, geometric definition of the Lie derivative. Let us recall that for any path in the manifold, so for any map from some interval of the real lines, the parameter space, the parameter interval into the manifold, so this could be a time parameter, if you like to think of it in this way, a time parameter into points in the manifold. So gamma of t is some path in the manifold. For any such path in the manifold, we have a tangent vector associated with that path at some arbitrary point in time t naught. So I'm just reminding you of the definition of what a tangent vector is according to the geometric construction. Namely, a tangent vector, according to the geometric definition, is a map that maps functions f, such as the temperature function, into the evaluation of the tangent vector onto that function, which is defined to be the rate of change of, for example, the temperature function along that path at the point in question. So of course, this is mapping functions into functions into derivatives, or at a point, it's mapping functions into numbers, obeying the Leibniz rule because of the d by dt obeying the Leibniz rule. So you can also see this already, how this is the same as the algebraic definition. But we motivated it geometrically. Okay, so the direction vector, the tangent vector, is the map that gives you the rate of change of any scalar function at that point. So you take your scalar function, evaluate it on that path, and then calculate the rate of change of that scalar function, such as the temperature. That's a directional derivative. Now let's define what an integral curve is. Assume we're given a vector field psi on our manifold. Then we consider a path gamma in that manifold, and it is called an integral curve of the vector field if it just so happens that the path velocity at any point is matching the vector field at that point, right? So you have a vector field, and then if you interpret the vectors as velocity vectors, then if you can find a path through that vector field such that the tangents to the path are vectors which are exactly the vectors of the vector field at that point, then that path is an integral curve of that vector field. So for example, the vector field could be a snapshot of, let's say you have a liquid that's flowing in a particular way, and then you can view your vector field as being the velocity field in that fluid. Let's say it's a stationary flow, and then the path of one particle in that fluid would have, by construction, as its velocity vector, as its tangent vectors, exactly the velocities, of course, which would be the velocity field of that fluid. Now, from the theory of ordinary differential equations, one can prove that for every point in the manifold and any suitably smooth vector field, there always exists some maximal C infinity integral curve through that point. So whatever your vector field is, as long as it's, say, differentiable, let's say we want it to be smooth, if you have a vector field, you can always, through any point, you can find some finite, at least a finite length integral curve that goes through that. So that the vector field locally can always be interpreted as a velocity field of objects traveling there. This may not be possible globally, but locally it's always possible. Which means that if you give yourself a smooth vector field, then it can always be interpreted, at least locally, as a flow of something, a flow of a bunch of trajectories. And here's how we can visualize that. So imagine M is our differentiable manifold, and we are given a vector field xi on it. The vector field xi is, of course, going to be our direction vector field. It's going to be defining in which direction we want to lead differentiate. Right? So imagine we are having here a differentiable manifold, and we have a vector field on it. And that vector field we now interpret in our minds as a velocity vector field. And then we look at all the trajectories that have these exact velocities. And then let's say we give that flow a moment. We give that flow, I don't know, the range of parameter values from 0 to 1. And then that means that in this velocity vector field, every point will flow a certain finite distance. No matter where the point starts, if we follow the flow lines, if we follow the velocities given by our vector field, then we flow along some path. For example, this point is mapped into that point, this point might be mapped into that one, and so on. So the velocity vector field gives us these integral curves. And if we give ourselves a certain fixed finite parameter range, then these velocity curves, these integral curves, map any starting point into a final point. Which means that if we let our flow go on for a time epsilon, then we obtain a map that maps every point of the manifold into some neighboring point along the flow. But overall, this is a map from the manifold into the manifold, where every point is mapped into a neighboring point. We can view it like this. It's a diffeomorphism generated by the flow of the vector field, which maps our differentiable manifold into itself, mapping the point P into the point phi t of p, obtained by flowing along the vector field for the amount of time t. So, for example, this might be the point p, and then that's the point phi t of p, where it has flown along the vector field for time t. Now, since we have now a diffeomorphism from a differentiable manifold into a differentiable manifold, which happens to be the same manifold again, but it's just a map from differentiable manifold into a differentiable manifold, that diffeomorphism, which maps points into points, will induce a map from functions into functions, and therefore from tangent vectors into tangent vectors, and therefore from cotangent vectors into cotangent vectors, and tensors into tensors, all induced by that diffeomorphism. So what we are looking at is a one-parameter family of diffeomorphisms If t is a large number, the flow is a long distance. If t is a small number, we are flowing just a small distance. If t is zero, it's just the identity map that maps the manifold onto itself. But the point here is, the reason why we do this is that we want this map, the induced map from tangent into tangent spaces here, tangent space here to tangent space there, and tensor space here into tensor space there, because it gives us a map that relates tangent vectors here to tangent vectors there, tensors here to tensors there. But if we can map tensors from one point of the manifold to another point of the manifold, it means that we can compare them. We can take a tensor here and a tensor there and compare them by taking the induced map here, using it to map the tensor here into the tensor space over there, and then we can compare it with the tensor that we had over there already. We can take the difference between the two, for example, and then differentiate by the amount of time that we traveled. And in this way, we can define a Newton-Leibniz derivative. You see how the algebraic approach is less tedious? Okay. All right, so as we said, phi t is the flow generated by our vector field, our tangent vector field psi, and it induces then a map that maps the tangent and the tensors at the point p into tensors at the point where we flow to, phi t of p, and vice versa, of course. The inverse will map tensors living at a short distance away into tensors in the point that we are interested in. And that's what we will need. We will need the inverse of that map, right? Because remember, for Newton-Leibniz, we need to subtract f of x plus epsilon minus f of x. So the outputs of f here and there have to be living in the same space. So if you want to do the derivative at x, we have to take the output of the function at x plus epsilon and map it to the point x, map it to the tangent, to the tensor space at the point x. And we can do that using the inverse of that map. All right, so remember what a tensor field does. If tau is a tensor field, remember tau is not a timeline thing, tau is a tensor field. If tau is a tensor field, what does it do? It assigns to every point in the manifold a tensor, right? So tau of p is some element of the tensor space of s-fold covariant and r-fold contravariant tensors at the point p. Then we can, for example, define what we mean by a tensor field being invariant under the flow induced by a vector field psi. See, so we can look at what is the value of our tensor field at a point p? Well, it's the output of our tensor map, right? We just look at what the tensor is at the point p. But we can also look at the value of the tensor field at some nearby point. And then if we want to know whether that's a different tensor or the same tensor as the one that we started with, we have to use that map. So let us evaluate our tensor field at a point p, and then use that map to map that tensor into the tensor space at the faraway point, at the point that we flow to. So p is the starting point, and then we flow to another point, phi t of p. So we evaluate the tensor field at the point p, and then that tensor at the point p, we map into the tensor space at the point phi t of p. Now, if this is the same as the tensor that we look up at the point where we flow to, then we say the field hasn't changed. So if the image of the tensor field's value at P is the tensor field's value at the image of P, then the tensor field is said to not have changed. So we would say the derivative is zero, except that this is still a finite jump that we've done. The key point is that the phi star map allows us to map tensors from one tensor space into the tensor space around another point, and that allows us then to compare tensors at different points to each other. So now we can analytically define the Lie derivative of any tensor field at a point P, which we choose to be the point reached by some path gamma at time t0, where gamma is some trajectory, some path, which is induced by the flow of a vector field psi. But the definition is that the Lie derivative of a tensor field in the direction of the vector field psi at a point P with a path flowing through the point P and being tangent, having a tangent vector which is given by the flow of a vector field psi there, that Lie derivative is the limit for t going to zero of the tensor evaluated at the point where we want to calculate the derivative, and then we subtract it from the value of the tensor field at the faraway point phi t mapped into the tensor space at the point P by doing the inverse of the phi star map. Phi star gets us to the faraway point, phi star inverse gets us from the faraway point back to where we want to evaluate it. And then we divide by t, just like Newton-Leibniz always did. And the only non-trivial thing here is that we had to use this induced map in order to make tensors at different points comparable by mapping them into the same tensor space. So explicitly, we take the tensor field at the point P and subtract it from the tensor field at the faraway point, at the point where we flow to after flowing for a time t. And that tensor we map into the tensor space at the point P. So these two guys are living in the same tensor space, namely the tensor space to the point P. We can therefore take the difference, and then we divide that by the time that we flowed along the flow given by the vector field psi, take the limit for t going to zero, and that's our Lie derivative. How does that look like in a chart? Let's say phi is such a diffeomorphism. It maps psi, it maps coordinate x into x tilde. So where we flow to is given by the x tildes. X tilde of I is x of I, xi, plus some small flow. Okay, so we're describing the infinitesimal flow in the neighborhood of a point. The original coordinates of our point is xi, and then these coordinates change as time passes. So the original coordinates change linearly as time passes. Initially, it's just a Taylor expansion of the path, and these are the first Taylor coefficients, and there will be higher coefficients in principle. Then we can calculate what the Jacobian matrix is for this diffeomorphism that maps the manifold into the manifold. And the dx tilde by dx have a plus sign here, and the dx by dx tilde have a minus sign. Why? Just try it out. If you take this after that and contract indices, you should get the Kronecker delta up to order t squared terms, and you need the minus sign for this to happen. You see, a minus b times a plus b is a squared minus b squared. But that's what we want. and the b squared term is going to be a t squared term that goes away, and then we just have the a squared term, but that's just the Kronecker delta squared, that's a 1. Okay, so that's inverting matrices perturbatively. Then what is the image of the tensor under the flow backwards from the point that we float to? The xi tilde is the point that we float to. Well, we have to do two things. The tensor will transform because it is a tensor. So therefore, we're going to have all of these Jacobian factors. But also, the tensor will change its coefficient functions by Taylor expansion because we are changing the argument. So there are two things happening now. We have that as we map or pull back that tensor from the faraway point that we float to the point where we want to evaluate the Lie derivative, two things happen. The coefficient function has to be Taylor expanded to first order, but also the Jacobians, which transform the upper and lower indices, also have to be transformed to lowest order. And so overall, we get a Taylor expansion here of the, we still have to carry out that Taylor expansion. This is the tensor at the faraway point where the distance is meant to be first order in T. And then these Jacobian factors have pluses and minuses depending on whether they are this way round or that way round according to this. So we have to work out what all of this is. And what we obtain is, by the Taylor expansion here, we get the tensor at the point where we want to evaluate the derivative. The first term is, by the Taylor expansion, just the term where nothing changed. That's this term. And then we get a term to first order in the Taylor expansion, which is you take your tensor, differentiate it once, and you get the first power here. That's a Taylor expansion of this tensor, right? Just as coefficient functions, just view them as coefficient functions and do the Taylor expansion for small t. Then you have to differentiate this tensor. I mean, the lowest order term is just this tensor at x. And the first order term is this tensor differentiated with respect to each of its arguments, d by dxk, and then multiplied with t xi k. And that's what we have here. We have the xi k and the t. Okay, so that's what we have here. And we already have a t dependence here, linear t dependence, which means that in all those other terms, we only keep the Kronecker delta terms, because all the terms that have a t in there would be of order t squared, but they will go away in the Newton-Leibniz limit anyway. So all the t squared terms and higher than t squared terms go away already. And then there is another bunch of terms which arise from the zeroth order Taylor expansion here, so no time dependence here, no t dependence here, and all the linear terms here, linear in t, linear in t, linear in t, linear in t. So these are the terms we get. We get the term where nothing changed. We get the term arising from the first order Taylor expansion of the coefficient function. And then we get all the terms where this is the lowest order here, but first order in the Jacobians. These are these terms. Okay, so a term where nothing changed, a term from the first order Taylor expansion of the coefficient function, and then terms from the first order expansion of the positive Jacobian factors, and terms from the first order expansion of the inverse Jacobian factors, the ones with the negative sign. Now we can use that. We can use that we now calculated the pullback of the tensors. We can use that to calculate our Lie derivative, as we said, as the limit for t going to zero of 1 over t times the pulled back tensor minus the original tensor. Remember that in this formula here, we had the original tensor as the leading term. So that's going to go away here, as always in the Newton-Leibniz limit. And then we are left with three types of terms. The Lie derivative produces three types of terms. One term from the Taylor expansion of the coefficient function. So This is the term where you have the coefficient functions of our tensor and then differentiate that coefficient function with respect to k. Oh, I should say that from this point onwards, we're using Einstein's summation convention, which is to say that whenever two indices occur, one up, one down, it is implied that we sum over them. All right, so the first term arises from the Taylor expansion of the coefficient functions at this one, and it's recognizable by having a comma k. So there's a directional derivative of the coefficient functions. And then all the other terms do not differentiate the tangent, the tensor field itself, but instead these terms differentiate the direction vector field psi itself. And there are terms with negative prefactors and terms with positive prefactors, with minus one and plus one in front of them, depending on whether we are contracting here with a contravariant or covariant index. So these terms arise from the derivatives of the Jacobian factors. So in particular, what you can see here is that if you want to do a Lie derivative in the direction of a vector field whose coefficients are constant, imagine that your vector field psi has coefficients 3, 7, 2, and 1. So if you write it as a vector field, it's always 3, 2, 7, 1, 1, or whatever. For all x, everywhere in the manifold, it's numerically the same vector. Right? Well, then what's the Lie derivative? Then it's literally just differentiating the coefficient functions, because all the other guys are not there. Okay? So a lot of the non-triviality of the Lie derivative arises from the fact that the direction vector field that defines the direction in which you differentiate is itself dependent on space and time. The Lie derivative knows that. That's important. I mean, why would that come into it? Well, it has to come into it because remember that the Lie derivative relied on the vector field to define a flow. And so how the vector field psi is changing determines the flow and therefore the identification of the tensors and therefore affects the definition of the Lie derivative of the Newton-Leibniz limit. Now let's see, is this definition equivalent to the algebraic definition of the Lie derivative? Well, it can't be completely equivalent because this definition works for all tensors, not just for the covariant and the symmetric tensors, which are the differential forms. It works for all of them. But is our geometric definition of the Lie derivative that we just did, or analytic definition, is it at least the same? Is it the same when applied to differential forms? Yes, that's true. We can check, for example, that the action on zero forms and one forms is the same. So if tau is a zero form, so it's just a function, then what is the Lie derivative according to what we just obtained? Well, the Lie derivative of a function is, well, there are three types of terms, right? It's the derivative of the coefficient function, and then you also get terms from the derivative of the direction vectors, but they have to contract the tensor. In this case here, it's simply xi k tau k. It's just the first type of term that ever occurs, because there are no Jacobian factors. The function is scalar. There are no Jacobian factors. So that's what it is, which is xi k d by dxk tau k. Tau of x, which is of course just the action of the tangent vector on tau. This is how we defined how the Lie derivative had to act on zero forms anyway, algebraically. So yes, that's what it does. It's just the gradient there. Now let's see how the Lie derivative geometrically, analytically defined, acts on a covector field. So now tau is assumed to be a one form. Then what does the Lie derivative do? Well, the Lie derivative acting on our one form going to be the first type of term is the directional derivative where we differentiate the coefficient function itself, this term. And then there's one more term arising from the Jacobian factors. There's going to be one Jacobian factor in this case because the cotangent vector field is a covariant tensor of rank one. So when it transforms, it picks up one Jacobian factor. And so we get one extra term here. And remember, that term will leave the coefficient function the same, but the direction vector field now gets differentiated. So we get this. And if you want to do a little exercise, check that this is also exactly what we found earlier for the algebraic definition of what the Lie derivative is supposed to do on one form. All right, now let's collect a few properties of the Lie derivative defined on all tensors, not just differential forms. So the Lie derivative always maps by the way we constructed RS tensors into RS tensors. It doesn't change the rank of tensors at all because we're just taking differences between tensors, tensor here, tensor there, through the pullback map, and then taking a limit. So that doesn't change the rank of the tensors. But just like the Lie derivative maps S forms into S forms, it also maps RS tensors into RS tensors. And in particular, the Lie derivative of a vector field can now also be defined. You see, for differential forms, we didn't have that because vector fields are not differential forms. Covector fields are differential one forms, but vector fields are not differential forms. And tangent vectors are not differential forms. But tangent vectors are tensors. They are 1-0 tensors. And we can now differentiate, Lie differentiate any tensors, including vector fields. So we can now also define what is the, we have now also defined the Lie derivative of a vector field. So we can now differentiate a vector field in the direction of another vector field. And what you can verify is that the Lie derivative in the direction of a vector field psi of a vector field eta is simply the commutator between the two. Now, does the Lie derivative that we defined for general tensors, does it obey a Leibniz rule? It turns out, yes, it does. It turns out that the tensors also form an algebra, not only under the wedge product. Not only is it true that the antisymmetric covariant tensors form an algebra under the wedge product, but also all tensors together form an algebra under forming the tensor product. And the Lie derivative is a derivation of that algebra. It is a derivation of the algebra of tensors. And we see that, we can check that by checking that, I mean, first of all, it's a linear map, of course, but also that it obeys the Leibniz rule. Namely, it obeys the Leibniz rule in the sense that the Lie derivative of the tensor product of two tensors is given by the distribution of the Lie derivatives on the two factors separately and then adding them up. Okay, so now we've done the Lie derivatives as well. I should say that today I will fly to Europe for a conference. I will be gone for a week. I will be back the week after, next week. Two of my PhD students will teach this class, so it will be happening just as usual, Tuesday and Friday at 4 p.m. in this room. But Maria will teach it on Tuesday and Nitika on Friday. Right. Don't grill them too much. No, I mean, they're great, but nervous. All right. Okay, any questions? All right, so I see you then, I think on the 2nd of October. Okay, see you next week.